Coming up on Life is a Festival.
Lately, I've become less and less interested of whether it's a feminine practice or a masculine practice. Like, it's less important to me. I'm not responding against anything anymore. It's like the self-trust has been cultivated. And so now it doesn't matter how it's categorized in some ways. Also, I have a lot more openness around what's actually happening when I'm surrendering my body and energies moving through it. Different people would define it in different ways. A tantric teacher might look at it as kundalini moving, or someone with a trauma background would look at it as like stuck energy, trauma unexpressed, moving through the body and getting to move. There's a woman called Emily Conrad. I looked at her work for a while. She's got a body of work called Continual Movement. She was a dancer, and so she looked at it as water moving under the skin, which is beautiful. It's like, does it really matter what we call it? Does it matter whether it's a masculine or feminine experience? I'm just less attached to that now.
Hello, my friends and fellow travelers. Welcome back to Life is a Festival. I'm your host, Eamon Armstrong. Today on the show, we are welcoming back Tina Nance. As you may recall, I did a yin yoga teacher training with Tina Nance in Bali many years ago. And last time she was on the show, we talked about yin yoga and embodiment and some of the work she did with feminine mysteries. Today on the show, I wanted to continue this exploration that we've been doing on gender and sexuality and speak a bit about feminine mysteries, and also most especially how Tina's perspective of gender has evolved in the intervening years. On the show, we discuss the idea of processing trauma in the nervous system. Is there some finite amount of psychological garbage that needs to run through your system for you to be healed? We talk about embodying mythopoetic femininity through the Egyptian pantheon. And I've been super into mythology lately, so it was really nice to explore this feminine mythology. We talk about masculine archetypes and what it means to be a male in 2024. We discuss the problem with the concept of divine feminine. We talk about viewing polarity through masculine and feminine, or Shiva Shakti, or yin and yang, and the value of each perspective. We talk a bit about menstruation from a mythopoetic perspective. We discuss the yang of Kuan Yin as a mythopoetic perspective on the modern trans movement. And then we end our show with Tina's newest offering, Held, which you'll hear more about on the show. So Tina Nance has over 25 years of yoga practice and nearly two decades of teaching. She specializes in yoga, somatic inquiry, and women's wellness across the globe through classes, workshops, retreats, and teacher trainings. She's the founder of Held, which is a school of embodied self-integration. She focuses on yoga therapy, yin yoga, restorative yoga, and techniques for nervous system regulation and trauma integration. A key figure at the Yoga Barn in Bali, Tina leads extensive training programs and is currently developing the Held Online Yoga and Embodiment School. She holds advanced qualifications in yoga therapy, health sciences, and various therapeutic modalities. And now, here is Tina Nance. Tina, welcome to Life is a Festival. Welcome back to Life is a Festival. This is our first time speaking in about 4 years.
Mm-hmm. Four big years.
Yeah, from just at the beginning of the transition, uh-huh. The great transition. And then prior to that, I met you in Bali in 2018. Mm-hmm. And for the listener who might not have heard Tina's first appearance, my experience with Tina was I went to a yin yoga class that you taught at Yoga Barn, and I was like, what is this? How is this? It was so deep for me, the experience. And a lot of it had to do with you and your presence and your clarity and this beautiful union of real, tangible scientific knowledge around what you were doing and knowledge of different wisdom traditions, and also just this emanating force of safety and peace. Mm. There was going to be an all-day workshop.
sign up for the all-day workshop. Then I did the all-day workshop, and I was like, oh, shit, I need more of this. So then I did a two-week teacher training.
You jumped right in.
I jumped right in, never to become a teacher. I sometimes will suggest yin to people. I still do yin yoga. But you showed me yin yoga as like a spiritual path. Not only was yin yoga so powerful for me, but just the concept of yin and my relationship to yin was very much like anchored in meeting you. And then we spoke about that on a podcast in 2020. And now much has changed. And now we are here in this moment. I'm in Bali for the first time in many years. And I wanted to talk to you about yin, about the feminine, about the evolution of self through the understanding of gender and through polarities. Mm. And I have some questions that I think our audience will want to know what you think about, but specifically, like, I have some things I just really want to know what you think about right now.
Great.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm excited. Let's go.
So just to locate our listeners with you, in our warm-up, you were talking about how a major part of your path has been trusting yourself, trusting your body, trusting your interoception, and that that was a path through your own trauma. And I think many listeners can resonate with the path of working with trauma and then the treasures that come out of that and the ability to serve others. So as a way of locating our audience, what flavor trauma do you have? What's your flavor?
What's your flavor?
What's your chili trauma?
I think it's a little bit of everything, to be honest. I think there is developmental stuff like all of us. Well, I shouldn't say all of us, like a large majority of us. And then I experienced quite a few back-to-back shock traumas where I witnessed some pretty intense violence, where I experienced a pretty horrific death of people quite close to me. A bunch of things back-to-back. And then on top of that, some chronic stress from just working around the clock and then still having to show up for work when I was in a traumatized state because of these events. And my nervous system just got to a point where it went, yeah, we're not doing this anymore. And I developed some pretty severe nervous system dysregulation.
What does that look like?
For me, it looked like really intense anxiety, which was showing up on a physical and a mental level. It looked like having sort of a permanent shake or tremor. It started having panic attacks that then finally developed into a panic disorder where I was having them about every 20 minutes or so. So
what year was this when that evolved to that state?
January 2019 is when it started. And it lasted. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And then it lasted for about 6 months. Yeah. It was immediately after the death of my father, which happened in a pretty horrific way. And then it just brought up a lot of stuff to the surface that had happened previously that my system thought that it had dealt with, but had on some level disassociated from because it wasn't quite ready. And then, as is the nature of trauma, when something really big happened, my body decided, okay, it's now. we're gonna meet it all now, which was incredibly overwhelming. Parts of my being had been in freeze state and then came out of freeze, which massively amped up my fight flight, and my body couldn't self-regulate it. My vagal brake came off, which just means the job of my vagus nerve to bring me back down was massively impaired. So I couldn't come down. So it was terrifying. And I had to learn the tools of how to bring myself back into regulation. And so to do that, I worked with incredible trauma therapists, and me just being me after I got better, I was like, what was that? I want to learn that. I'm already an embodiment and a yoga teacher. I couldn't not start to include it in my practice. So then I went on that path and did Peter Levine's somatic experiencing training, the 3-year training, and did lots of nervous system study with different teachers, and started incorporating it in my work and my teaching. And yeah, that's been the journey. I think as a teacher and a practitioner and a student of self-inquiry, I've always been dealing with the little T's, with the smaller traumas. And then the big T's had a timing of their own. And when they all came up at once, then I was in an involuntary place of like, okay, like, let's figure this out. Which, thanks to Grace, I had the support to do so. And not everybody does. So I was very blessed. And so that's why I feel passionate about supporting other people in that similar position, you know?
When it comes to something like developmental trauma, which is small traumas over time building up, do we have some finite amount of sort of psychological garbage or somatic pain? Or is there a finite amount that is within our system, whether it's in our nervous system, whether it's in various tissues in our body? Is there a finite amount that needs to run through the nervous system in some way, and that once we have run it through, then it's gone and we won't have trauma responses or a reactivity in the same way? That was the frame I was working with for a while. But considering I've done a lot of what I feel is like running trauma through my system, like shaking these different kind of processes, I'm worried that maybe it's not like I need to do a certain amount of work and then I'm complete, and that maybe I'm just in kind of a loop.
God, there's so many things I could say to that. From the lens of Peter Levine, who is the guy that created somatic experiencing, there's this idea of completing a stress response. So if there's been fight, flight running in the system, fight, flight or freeze, that has to move all the way through to regulation and safety in the system. So for example, if I was in a situation where I was being threatened and I was able to respond to that by fighting or fleeing, and then I was in an environment where I could register that then I was okay and I was safe, that then that stress response moves through the system in a complete way. But so often, or what we could loosely define as trauma, is when that hasn't had a chance to occur, either developmentally or in a case of shock trauma or like an event. So then there's these incomplete stress responses stored in the system, like history in the tissues. So there is this sense of going in and unpacking that. But I'm not really one for going in to find the stuff and then moving it through and like continuing to dig until, I mean, I understand the attractiveness of it. And I definitely, having been someone that was like hit out of left field, was very interested in, have I got it all now? Have I got it all now? Or is this ever going to happen to me again? Because I don't want to go through that again. So I understand that desire to be like, what is it to go in, meet everything, move it out of the system, and then are we done? But having said that, really, for me, what I think it's about is meeting what's here when it arises, whenever it arises. So maybe that's never done. But the idea of, I think what I heard in your question was, is there a possibility that you can keep going in and doing these practices and you're just overcooking and it's not necessary?
Let me clarify the question. Mm. So many people pursue a healing journey.
Right.
They initiate, they become aware of there's some stuff that needs to get healed, some childhood trauma, some whatever right. it is, developmental trauma, and they start drinking ayahuasca or they start doing right. meditation or whatever. And I think that there's this idea that I need to do a certain amount of stuff.
Right.
And then when I'm done, then I don't have to focus on this so much and I can focus on my career and being of service or whatever. It seems like people have this like healing journey thing.
I don't think
thing.
It works like that.
Yeah.
I don't think we can compartmentalize it in that way. I think we get into a relationship and that relationship becomes a mirror that brings up certain things and we're like, okay, this is what's here now. I'm going to meet that now. Or we think we're doing great and then all of a sudden we go home and we're with our family or we get into a job or something shows up on the news that triggers something or whatever it is. I feel like the journey is really just developing the tools to meet whatever arises in the moment rather than going back into the past to meet all these things so that I can get on with a different future. I don't think it actually works like that.
Well, and it's interesting from your perspective, even if there was some certain amount of trauma that needed to run through the nervous system, let's say that was the case.
Yeah.
If you did have tools to meet whatever was arising and you were existing in more of a surrendered state in that you were letting things happen in your system, noticing them, and then meeting them with practices that were regulating, et cetera, then even if there was some stuff that needs to run through, you would actually be best positioning yourself to let that happen as a natural process versus excavating to like come to completion, which
yeah.
actually is more forceful.
Yeah. Yeah. First of all, forcing trauma release in itself is a bit of an oxymoron, meaning that what I see a lot of is, especially in my subculture, right, here in Bali and alternative subcultures, is there are a lot of people that are pushing the nervous system for trauma release. Mm. What's really important through the lens of somatic experiencing, for example, is that we are, sure, dipping our toe into what's called the trauma vortex, which means we are touching on things stored in the nervous system that are not yet complete, but we're touching on them and then we're titrating or pendulating towards regulation. And what I see is a lot of catharsis and a lot of pushing things through the nervous system and not a lot of knowledge or understanding or practice of nervous system regulation, which can often just look like what I sensed you were describing there of just like pushing and pushing the system, which doesn't actually lead to healing. It's important to touch on things and then regulate, and then touch on things and regulate. And the reason being is we can just re-traumatize the system, for one. But also, our nervous system is an intelligence. It doesn't respond to force. It's an intelligence that responds to safety. And so we need to create a container. We need to cultivate a strong enough nervous system to handle that level of voltage moving through it. And we do that through calming practices, regulating practices. So yeah, when we cultivate an environment of safety internally and externally, that's when the body says, oh, okay, now I'm safe enough to bring this next thing up to the surface. So it doesn't really work like the idea of going, okay, I'm just going to push this all through. It doesn't really work like that, you know?
I love the idea of co-regulation, that we as tribal primates, as the descendants of tribal primates, we regulate with each other. And I definitely felt when I was in Bali and I was first taking your yin yoga class, you were just like co-regulating the whole class. Then that we're in these long hold asanas and that we're feeling these sensations and we're meeting them with mindfulness. And as you see, I remember it's been like 6 years.
Yay!
But also that there's this creation of a sense of safety and a creation of a sense of safety. I think also in part just by you. And I was able to attend a class of yours this week that was very specifically in this modality that you've been working with, which is teaching nervous system regulation and downregulating the nervous system. And once again, I was like, you walked in the room. Someone else was like setting it up and then you walked in the room. And I was just like, okay. So I think that it's interesting too when you know, especially as an American, where we have a very individualistic culture, we can have this very individualistic, like I'm going to the Amazon to do this thing and then I'm going to sit in silence. And there's such a value in being together and being around regulated nervous systems.
Yeah.
And that teaches us and that we can co-regulate. I just love that. I think it's so cool.
I love that too. And yeah, I also just wanted to touch on this idea of timing, because it keeps coming up as you're speaking. That, for example, myself, I've been teaching embodiment and yoga for 24 years. And I've been on the mat and inside an embodied practice for my entire adult life. And yet these shock traumas that were deep inside my system, it wasn't time for them to come up until it was, despite the amount of work that I'd done. So, you know, this sense of going to the Amazon to go and do all the stuff, like I definitely, you know, being that person after, for example, my cousin, which was also my best friend, was murdered quite violently and I witnessed her body. After that event, I knew that that was going to have an impact, right? I'm like, okay, I have to deal with this. So me being me, I went, okay, I'm going to take myself off and do a silent retreat. What was I thinking? I'm going to do a silent retreat. Where I literally went into silence for a month. I didn't fast, but I cleansed and just did what I knew how to do. But what life taught me is not much came up in that moment. I felt quite regulated, actually, and that's what I needed in that time. My system needed to regulate. And it wasn't till, 10 years after, that it then was ready to arise in the system. So there is, call it divine timing or the intelligence of the body or the creation of safety, the environment of whatever that is. It's outside of our control, I think. I mean, we can participate to some degree. We can create space in our life so we're not disassociating. We're like, okay, I'm actually available and I'm here and I'm getting into my body. I'm doing what I can do. But it's going to do what it wants to do when it wants to do it. When I say it, I mean the nervous system. I think, yeah, I think there's a timing that's outside of the I that plays a very big role in this. I just wanted to talk about that.
What I really like about your work is that, first of all, with yin yoga, it's very syncretic overall. We have long hold asanas. We have traditional Chinese medicine, Buddhist mindfulness. You bring a lot of different perspectives. And so I want to be able to touch on a couple of them. And first of all, I want to touch on this idea of the mythopoetic. So when we did our yin yoga teacher training, you brought in a Chinese medicine instructor.
Jimmy Willumban.
Dr. Jimmy, who was teaching about five elements theory in Chinese medicine, but he was doing it through a mythopoetic lens. Mm-hmm. And when we've spoken about feminine mysteries and feminine arts, and even, I know you have a connection to Egypt, for example, mm-hmm. like these are mythopoetics, yeah. these are mythopoetic approaches. Yeah. And I'll just say my own perspective here is that mythology is a technology that is not verified through scientific experiment. It's verified through its value of culture over centuries. So if a story lasts centuries, that means it has been tested over and over again and adapted and changed through cultures. And that is its verification. And so the mythopoetic is like, how do we find wisdom within stories and within these ways of looking at the world, that there's actually wisdom that our intellectual mind, oh, we can link it back to the mind, the developing trauma mind.
look at that,
it works. Our big smart adult brains that are often educated through this really kind of linear, very masculine, you might say, very young, you might say, way of learning. The mythopoetic is a way of kind of getting around that, because myths aren't true, but yeah. they are true because what they teach you is true.
Yeah.
So that's how I feel about the mythopoetic. I love it. I'm so into myth. How does this perspective factor into the work you've done over your career and into what you've been doing now with this nervous regulation, nervous system regulation?
Big question. For me, it always comes back to tying it into the body as well. Like, I can't speak about anything without it being embodied, because that's just the lens that I experience things. So for example, if we were talking about the Egyptian pantheon of deities, right? If we're talking about the feminine, if we're looking at the female deities of the Egyptian pantheon, for me, what they represent is different facets of the feminine, right? So whether it's been interpreted through a religious lens and you're thinking that deities exist as gods in some realm, or whether you're, at the end of the day, it's representing a part of us. Right? So if we look at Sekhmet, for example, she's the lion-headed goddess, and she represents fierce compassion. She's like the Kali of the Indian pantheon, right? So she represents compassion that is so fierce it'll rip your head off you if you're not in alignment with your truth, as opposed to a soft, gentle, heart-centered compassion, or motherly, more maternal compassion, or Isis, or, you know, Hathor, which is more around pleasure. It's using the stories and the representation of these attributes of these, of the personalities of these deities, to invoke an understanding of a different part of ourselves. And I love that. And then for me, it's very much about embodying that, because it's one thing to learn about these things mentally, but I think the way that we really integrate our own experience is via the body. So for example, the way that I work with the Egyptian deities is to get a cognitive sense of what they represent, and then to choose music and environments that kind of represent that, and then to explore a sort of surrendered movement inside of that context. If I'm dancing Hathor, who is the goddess of pleasure and art and music and sensuality and celebration and reverie and rapture and all those delicious things, then I would use that kind of movement and have that kind of fabrics around, and then be exploring that energy in my own body, and it brings up that part of me, and then I'm attuning to and listening to that part of me. So I'm using this myth, this story that's part of the ancient Egyptian culture, and then moving it through my body, which is the way that I learn the most, in order to integrate that understanding in my being. And then same with Sekhmet, fierce compassion, that would be like more like, and really feeling that energy and what that would feel like to be like, to really embody, fuck no. Am I allowed to say that on here?
Fuck yeah, you are. You do what you want, it's my show.
Yay. Like, to really embody these things, because for me, the mythopoetic is always bringing us back to ourselves. Otherwise, they're just ideas, right? If it's about integration, if it's actually going to have an effect on our life and who we are moment to moment, then again, from my lens, it's about moving that through our own experience, moving that through our bodies. And as an embodiment junkie, that's the way that I do it.
So much about this is so resonant with me. Mm. So my book, 22 chapters, each chapter is governed by an archetypal figure or deity. Huh. So I'm really in this right now, psychologically myself. I want to say that. Quick question. Do you primarily work with the Egyptian pantheon? Because I do know that Egypt has been meaningful for you. Yeah. Are you working with other goddess figures in the context of these integration practices?
I mean, right now I'm not working with that anymore. That's a journey that I've been on. And I have worked with, you know, Indian deities, and my background being in yoga, and Kuan Yin because of Taoism. You know, I've exposed myself to lots of different ways of thinking and then explored that through the body via deities. But it's not a current practice of mine. I feel like that was something that I was exploring that, yeah, that showed me what it needed to show me.
Yeah, and it's interesting on the masculine side, or maybe on the male side would be a better way of saying it. On the male side, we have the mythopoetic men's movement, which was in the 80s and 90s, a response to second wave feminism. And there's two big books for that movement, which is one is Iron John, which is about reconnecting with this figure of the wild man, primarily, although there's other features. And then this book, King, Warrior, Magician, Lover. And these are the four archetypes for aspirational masculinity. And many men, myself included, grabbed a hold of this book and were basically like, okay, so I can be a man, not in the traditional macho lens that I started with, but also not in the self-negating feminism, unhealthy feminism, that's sort of like the man needs to be made smaller to balance things out. And if you're a good man, you'll make yourself small you're doing your part by making yourself small. So it wasn't that. It's, okay, here are archetypes, a king, a warrior, a magician, and a lover, and we can live into these archetypes. However, what I've noticed is that this book has become canon for men's work in such a way that these are the only archetypes that we're really working with. We got a king, a warrior, magician, and a lover. And they're talked about so much that it's, in some ways, they lose their fervor. And it's been really interesting for me to be looking at these different archetypal figures that are, a lot of them relating to gender for me, masculine and feminine, my own feminine, that sort of thing. But just like, what does it look like to use archetypes as kind of an avatar of expression that unlocks a certain way of being? I love these figures in this way. And even as you were just talking about these feminine deities and as a way of connecting with femininity through these deities, I was seeing kind of the mirror of what we've been doing on the men's side of things. Mm-hmm. And it actually gave me a different insight into this kind of goddess culture thing, which for me, and this is something I definitely wanted to talk to you about, my quills kind of stand up a little bit with phrases like divine feminine and sacred masculine and these sorts of things where it seems like what we are on this earth as human beings isn't enough or is somehow wrong, and that we need to be these sort of divine, sacred things.
100%.
But then there's also, I see so often that is kind of shorthand for a certain kind of, and I don't like the term narcissism because it's not a pathology, but it turns into a kind of self-aggrandizing thing, which
which also is coupled with shadowing parts of yourself. If you're splitting yourself like that, where you're, before you use the term aspirational aspects of the masculine, I liked that. But even inside of that, I've seen that inverted commas spiritual subculture my whole life, which is this idea of glorifying the higher self. The byproduct of that, while that's great in many ways, the byproduct of that is the amount of stuff that's then in the shadow that's disassociated from and disowned. And that really authentic spiritual practice, I think, is about reintegrating those parts. That's what I love about IFS. You and I spoke about that in previous podcast. What I loved about IFS is I feel like it has this capacity to anchor you in this adult self, capital S, this fuller self that has access to intuition and wisdom and knowing. But then there's this process of going and reintegrating and reparenting and re-being with, in a compassionate and curious way, all parts of the being, this sense of integrated wholeness, as opposed to just let's get to the higher self and pretend nothing else is important. Yeah, I think that's, yeah. So the idea of being aspirational or a part of your being that you're aspiring to, I think that has to include inclusivity of all parts of the being at some point, you know, integration and inclusiveness. Otherwise, we're just splitting off from parts of ourselves that are our nature. And that's obviously problematic, right?
You know, I've been thinking a lot and I've been studying a lot what it means to be a man in this 2024.
Can I ask why you've been in that inquiry? Like, what is it that inspires that as such a thirst?
So I think that for male-bodied people, there's kind of an idea of being a man, like from when you're really little. A man is something that you do. You have to be a man. And for me, one of my early wounds is around the kind of my multiplicity of my being, particularly around gender, was rejected. And I rejected it myself, exiled my feminine. I needed to cross my legs the right way. I needed to, couldn't wear pink, couldn't be girly. And I'm a girly man at times. And when I look at myself as being unfree and in the process of becoming free, as my spiritual aspiration is to be more liberated and to help other people be liberated. This question of like what it means to be a man was very interesting to me. Yeah. And I got engaged and I was moving towards marriage because that was just the script that I had. Mm-hmm. That's what you do. And then when the engagement ended, which was a little bit before you and I met, I was juggling these kind of topics and being like, oh, is monogamy actually right for me? Should I investigate ethical non-monogamy? What do I think about masculinity? And I think a lot of people go through that where they're following a path, they've gone to college, they've gotten that kind of corporate job, they're getting married, and then all of a sudden some aspect of that is revealed to be not what they really want and maybe even harmful to them. And so that's often when we kind of go on the healing journey.
Right.
And for me, a lot of it has been around sexuality and masculinity.
Yeah.
And what it means to be a man evolved from like a gender question to a maturation question. So it wasn't, what does it mean to be a man who's not a woman? Like, how do I show the world my masculinity and how much of a man I am that I'm not feminine? To how can I be one of the adults in the room?
Right.
How can I be a mature man?
Yeah.
I turned 42
like
next week.
Showing up with integrity.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Well, and that's the word. Integrity to mm-hmm. me, where I've come down to with all of it is that what it means to be a man is, first of all, a man is not a man that is not a boy.
Yeah.
Not a man that is not a woman. And a man that is a man
that.
A man that is not childish, but has the capacity to be childlike.
Mm-hmm. By choice.
So there's a couple of caveats here. But for me, when I think of what it means to be a man, to have matured to say, I am a man, I'm an adult. And for me, it's I am a man, I'm an adult male, I'm a man in the world. To have integrity, that's the foundational one. What I say is true. I do what I say.
I keep my word.
And the nature of my integrity can actually create more integrity in the spaces I'm
in.
Holding other people accountable, mm-hmm. lovingly calling people in and calling them up rather than calling people out. But all of that to me is in the realm of integrity and working on one's own personal integrity.
Mm-hmm.
And then one thing for me is I don't really like the term service as much these days because it's got a certain baggage for me. I like to use the term helpful. I like to be in integrity and I like to be helpful.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, those qualities are more important than being strong and being an endurance and being stoic or like whatever I might have thought of as a child. And the last thing I'll say about that question about my preoccupation with what it means to be a man, it's like a nerdy interest of mine, and I like it as a nerdy interest. I like going deeper into it, and I like learning more about gender. And in the same way that you were saying earlier that your understanding of the feminine has changed, my understanding of the masculine has changed. And when I think about what it means for this sort of fashionably bisexual, somewhat gender fluid, traveling podcaster man to be an adult man, integrity is key and being helpful.
Mm. Yeah, I love that. First of all, like just the courage that it takes to be, like at what age did you start that? How old are you when that big quest came about? So you said it was after you broke up with your fiance?
So my threshold points were at 25, I stopped blaming my dad for all my problems and started actually taking responsibility for my life to a certain degree.
Yeah.
So that was the first kind of threshold for me where I was like starting a maturing process. 28, a couple of years later, I stopped drinking alcohol and started doing yoga. Starting yoga was big, I didn't understand it that way then, but starting a practice.
Mm.
So that, then the next one was ending the engagement, which was super hard. And similar to you, actually, I've thought of you a lot about this. Actually, when I was writing, I thought about you. It's funny, I was writing just about you the other day, about you telling our class about going through a breakup and being so wounded, you couldn't even get out of bed and mm-hmm. you were just crying all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And that how much you learned in the crucible of that experience.
Yes.
For me, ending the engagement was that kind of crucible.
Yeah.
And that was 33. That was almost 10 years ago.
Right.
And then I would say the next threshold after that was when I started challenging my own magical thinking and stopped wanting to be the hero of my own story and realized that weaving a heroic story about myself was actually holding me back and putting me in a cul-de-sac of like healing and myopic self-interest.
Right.
While I thought that I was like healing and growing and changing, what I was really doing is just being self-obsessed.
Right.
And that's why I do a podcast versus, I'm talking a lot on this podcast, but often I'm focusing on other people. So there's that threshold. And then I would say the most recent one was just enough in my life stabilizing around what substances I was doing, the way I have romantic relationships, that I actually have more capacity to be helpful and that I'm very concerned with being helpful.
Yeah.
And so those are kind of like the steps for me of maturation into my masculine,
yeah,
into my like man self.
Beautiful. I love that. What an inspiring journey. I think, yeah, what I was touching on before is I think it requires enormous courage to go beyond what you've been conditioned and appropriated into and to stand for something, especially because there is an awareness that whatever we're standing for is constantly changing. We're standing on shifting sands. So just being willing to be like, I'm going to be out loud about the exploration and the inquiry, and I might change my mind a lot. That's very honest.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that developing self-trust is what I think the authentic spiritual path ends up being. It's like we take on lots of ideas, whether it's from our conditioning, our culture, our school, our parents, our development, all of that kind of stuff, but also from all the books that we read and all the people that agree with us and on our opinions because we've all read the same things and sat with the same teachers. And there's just a constant molding of self that life seems to continually smash open. And I feel like that's the spiritual path, this smashing of the idea of self that's not actually true. And it takes a lot of courage to show up for that and be like, all right, yeah. And developing what I call unfuckable self-trust. Like I know that there's a part of me inside of all of that that's wanting to be known and integrated and embodying that is essential to health and well-being and let alone fulfillment and contentment. And so I think it's a very admirable path.
Thank you. Before I took up a lot of airtime with my admirable path, which was not the intention, but that is fine. I was poking a little bit at this kind of what I've talked about as goddess culture. And that's actually, to put those two things together, me saying what my path is and also this idea of goddess culture, I'm curious about your path as a woman. First of all, whether you think of yourself as a woman in the way that I think about myself as a man, is it something that you just are a woman, or is there a thing you do to be a woman? Like similarly, like I have this aspirational, mature masculine, and I'm curious what you think about an aspirational feminine, because to me, goddess culture isn't it.
Describe what you mean to me by goddess culture. Do you mean tiara wearing, superficial?
Yeah, I mean you're in the linen and taking the taking the photos by the waterfall.
I might have linen pants on right now.
I mean, linen's good in this environment, but I mean like white linen. Well, you are wearing white linen, but
you better be careful. No, I'm just kidding.
But like there's
I know what
there's
you
a
mean,
pageantry
yes,
of the
course.
Self. That is dressed up in feminism.
Yeah.
And I don't say much about it because I'm a man, so I don't want to be like...
It's not that different to like the alpha male or the, I don't know, plastic surgery, busty short skirt. Like they're all just superficial coatings over a sense of insufficiency, right?
The point I'm making about this, what I've called goddess culture, or I guess just kind of spiritual, what people say is spiritual narcissism, specifically related to someone's feminism, femininity. Someone's femininity is that I don't think that this kind of goddess culture, wearing certain things, I've done so many ceremonies and that sort of thing, I don't think that is aspirational femininity. I think what you have done and what you project in the world is, to me, very powerful femininity,
yeah,
and isn't that? And so that's what I'm curious is, how do you think of this and how do you think of your own femininity?
How do I talk about this? What's interesting as I've matured and like in my maturation process is that I've become less concerned about it than I used to be. And I think it's because part of that development of unfuckable self-trust was me owning a path that wasn't yet very represented outside of me, and it felt like a feminine path. So what I mean by that is, so my background for a long time in terms of study and practices and what I was immersed in were masculine wisdom traditions, right? So yoga and Taoism and Chinese medicine and Buddhism. And most of these were written by men for men. You know, women had very little voice in the times that they were written and weren't practitioners much, right? So inside of that immersion into those wisdom traditions, I was developing fantastic qualities that were really supportive for me. Things like, I think we might have discussed this on the last podcast, but things like equanimity, the capacity to rest as that vast open awareness that could hold and embrace all that was moving inside. More meditative consciousness, awareness orientated practices. Whereas what was happening for me was what became much more compelling was practices that were responding to the Shakti that was moving inside my body. So in other words, when I was doing stillness practices, I was observing a lot of internal movement, and I got more curious about the internal movement than I did about the space that was holding it. That was just more compelling for me. As a woman or as a human, I don't know, right?
Shiva is stillness, and then Shakti is creative movement.
That's right. Through the yogic lens, this kind of polarizing of masculine and feminine is that Shiva is the stillness, the all-embracing awareness that's holding all that is, unchanging, unmoving. And then Shakti is everything inside of that, the manifest. So there's unpotentialized awareness, and then there's everything that's manifest inside of that, the manifest being the feminine, Shakti. So through that particular lens, that's what I mean, there's so many different lenses. Yin and yang is quite different. Through that lens, I started being more drawn towards embodiment and what was moving and arising and shifting and changing inside than I was about the changeless. I started to really get curious about what would happen to me on the yoga mat, how by doing certain shapes and postures and practices that history would start arising. And I wanted to learn how to be with what was coming up. And I started noticing the more embodied I became via my practices, that my body was this profound tool of, what's the best way to describe this? My body was constantly speaking to my alignment or misalignment with this essential part of myself, the truth inside. My body had this way of communicating that to me by expanding or contracting. And I started to get really curious about that. I wanted to find this place of truth inside of myself. And then I got really interested in the female hormonal path and menstruation and how I had much more access to the intuitive part of me and the knowing inside of me during pre-menstruation and menstruation. I became really curious about that. And I also started to notice that when I was surrendering my body completely, that it was a very sensual experience and that I could explore that in my sexual life and my sensual life. And when I was doing that, it was actually a divine experience. And so I started noticing that the parts of my human experience that were denied in many religions, masculine created religions, and even the wisdom traditions, so the body, blood and menstruation, sexuality, the places where I was told not to look and to overcome my emotionality, emotional intelligence, the places that I was supposed to be transmuting and transforming or in religious structures, negating altogether, were actually my sources of power. That was where I was finding my truth, finding my access to the divine, in inverted commas, finding raw power was in these places where I was being told not to look. So I was like, what's that about? And of course, I wanted to look. I wanted to look under that carpet. And so the reason that self-trust has become so important to me is to do that required a lot of unfuckable self-trust, because I was being told that that wasn't correct, but it was my experience. So that's why I say I admire you for your journey, because I know what it takes to go, everybody's saying that, but I'm going to look over there. And so that's why in the beginning it felt like a feminine path to me, because this was something that was happening through a female body and what felt like a female experience that hadn't been dealt with through the masculine lens of masculine written spiritual traditions. So it felt like that for a while. But then eventually over time, and you know, I explored these and then created spaces where I was supporting other women to explore in this way and created environments that I called the embodied feminine, where we're exploring these things through our body. But lately, I've become less and less interested of whether it's a feminine practice or a masculine practice. Like it doesn't, it's less important to me. I'm not responding against anything anymore. It's like the self-trust has been cultivated. And so now it doesn't matter how it's categorized in some ways. Also, I have a lot more openness around what's actually happening when I'm surrendering my body and energies moving through it. Different people would define it in different ways. A tantric teacher might look at it as kundalini moving, or someone with a trauma background would look at it as like stuck energy, trauma unexpressed, moving through the body and getting to move. There's a woman called Emily Conrad. I looked at her work for a while. She's got a body of work called Continual Movement. She was a dancer, and so she looked at it as water moving under the skin, which is beautiful. It's like, does it really matter what we call it? Does it matter whether it's a masculine or feminine experience? I'm just less attached to that now. But I feel like I needed to do that for a while. And maybe that's, how do I want to say this? You spoke before about this idea of the masculine in response to feminism having to become smaller to create space. I feel like when something has been oppressed, it then has to be this kind of rebellious pushback against something, and then it just becomes what it is. I think it's kind of like that. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Well, there's also, you know, the expansion and contraction in our bodies, expansion and contraction in our cultures. Mm. Tina, one of the things that I love about interviewing you is also one of the things that is most challenging about interviewing you, which is that there's like a dozen things that I want to do.
I feel the same when you're speaking. There's, I'm like, I want to like go into
a dozen things that I want to go into. But I've got a good one right now, okay. And we're going to do my good one. Is it potentially more helpful, rather than to even use the frame of feminine and masculine, to use a frame like yin and yang? And we talked about Shiva Shakti. I'm less familiar with Shiva Shakti. And for me, Shiva Shakti seems to map more onto masculine and feminine. Yin and yang seem to be concepts that can be looked at as...
Less loaded.
They're less loaded. You are a yin yoga instructor. Uh-huh. There's a reason why yin is used in that title.
Yeah.
You know, I was talking to my mentor and spiritual guide, Benjamin. Shout out, Benjamin. Always and forever, about how I got to Thailand and I was doing this like hot girl summer thing where I was like really leaning into expressing my feminine. I had like a pink scooter and like I felt really cute and like zipping around the island. And he kept kind of bringing it back to like playing with yin versus being a girl. And so I wonder if maybe the entire topic of gender, because there is polarity within gender and there is polarity in sexuality. Like, that polarity is valuable.
Yes.
But polar opposites bring things together. They magnetize. And we live in a dual realm for reasons. If we didn't live in a dual realm, we would be the sort of non-dual oneness, which is great, but that's not what we're doing here. So we need polarity. We need some kind of masculine and feminine. And at the same time, we can get so stuck in these concepts, and yeah, particularly culturally. So I'm curious, can we use yin and yang instead? Do you use yin and yang instead? How have those... And if you want to throw in some Shiva Shakti, I wouldn't hate it. And then I'm going to throw in some Kuan Yin after I've got a lot going on.
Yes, I definitely use yin and yang more than I use masculine and feminine. And mainly because it is so loaded. And I'm wanting to create more trauma-informed containers, really, where I'm triggering people less and supporting people more. The thing about yin and yang is they're really just terms that are defining a relationship, the defining relativity, right? Something's more yin in relationship to something that's more yang, right? Yin and yang terms are definitely more fluid just in their nature. Something is only yin in contrast to something else, never just on its own is solidly yin. So I think that's useful. Also, one of the ways you can define yang is that it's the energy that's moving up and out. So it's a productive energy. It's a manifesting energy. It's a making shit happen energy. It's creative in that it's what it's achieving and producing and doing and getting out there. Whereas a way of defining yin is that it's in and down. So the yin energy is slowing down and drawing our energy inwards, noticing what's happening internally, not just focusing on what's happening externally. And that's really useful, practices like yin yoga, and where they're really practices of slowing down enough to be able to attune to your internal environment and then just opening up that whole internal landscape. That's why I call that a yin practice. In terms of masculine and feminine, I think it works to a point and then it stops working, you know? I think, like you said, there is definitely feminine essence, feminine energy and masculine essence, which is why there's this conversation that's a lot more popular now about where am I on that spectrum? What do I identify as? Do I identify as something or am I all of it? Or, you know, that's sort of this conversation. And yes, I think it's important in terms if there are parts of you that have been not able to be integrated or expressed or owned or allowed to be. And then also eventually I feel like, you know, it's ever changing, it's fluid, and it would be great to eventually get to a point where it doesn't necessarily matter, because it becomes less and less important, I think, once we're allowed to express all of ourselves and there's no fight in that. Then is it so important? Can't you just wear pink and you're a hot girl bike one day and then the next day and then the next moment and then...
But to me, that's the liberation.
That's right.
The liberation is to play with gender concepts, yeah, not to do away with them altogether.
Yeah.
Whether you want to be like a butch lesbian biker as a man, you want to be a butch lesbian biker as a man. That's so many layers of just gender things, but it's playful. It's fun.
Yes.
It's like, I'm going to be this. Trying on the faces of the divine through embodied practices, I'm going to be Isis, and Isis looks like this for
yes,
me.
Like
that it's playful and that it's not restrictive.
I think the choice, the being in a position of choice is really important. So for example, if we're talking about like masculine and feminine energies through more of a tantric lens, where we would talk about the part of me that's going out and creating my business is like when I get into my masculine, in inverted commas, right? Like say we were looking at it through that lens. If I go out and I'm like boss bitching all day and then I come home and I want to soften into my feminine so I can be with my man in a more surrendered way that we enjoy in our sensual dance, if that's my choice, then I want to have agency around that. I want to be able to come home and know how to hang up my boss bitch shoes and put on my little satin negligee and roll around on the floor for a bit and shift gears, right? I want to have access to different parts of me. I want to have agency to choose when I want to choose. I want to be self-aware enough to notice where I'm at and how the environment I'm in is responding to that, because it's not effective to be in that deeply feminine, luscious energy when I'm out boss bitching, nor is it effective for me in my relationship to come home and hold that energy in that environment in certain ways. So having the awareness to know when I'm in what's and the agency to choose what I want to be in and have the practices or the capacity to shift gears, that's where I think power is, you know?
So there's definitely a power and a liberation in trying things on. And at the same time, we are in biologically different bodies. Mm-hmm. In the trans movement, we have certain gender-affirming things, like you can take certain hormones, you can do certain things. I'm going to take that to the side for a moment, but just look at the male body, the female body. Mm-hmm. So one of the things I really love about what you do is the way that you hold the feminine from that perspective. Yep. You're the person who taught me about menstruation through a mythopoetic lens.
Yes. And my work here is done.
And I have had that conversation with all of my lovers since our conversation. And seriously, I'm so proud.
Aw.
it really moved me, and it really moved me as a male. So as a man, I'd always looked at menstruation as something that was inconvenient for a woman.
Sure.
And frankly, inconvenient for me.
Of course.
You know what I mean? Like, it's, oh, PMS. Like, I didn't even know that there were different aspects of a cycle. There was like bleeding and there was like being mean to me. Is that, that was the cultural frame when I was like a teenager. Now, it's, I want to know where my lover is at on her cycle. And I want to know what she likes when she's there. And I want to honor each part of it. Mm. And you taught me that, by the way.
Have you noticed that makes life a lot easier you as well?
Oh my God. Well, it's, you know,
it's a even, win-win.
You know, it's the level of communication that's possible between genders when you as a male have an understanding of that.
Yeah.
It's like super helpful.
Yeah. Because it really is like that. It's like going out with at least four different women and one woman's body because of the four phases of her cycle. But obviously there's so many more nuanced layers to it than that. But yeah, it really helps you with that sense of like, we're always going out with a multiplicity, right? But hormones make it very drastically so. Well, and definitive chapters each cycle.
Well, and you work with women and their hormones. You encourage practices. Can you throw in some resources for our women listeners as you begin to talk about this subject? Because I have a lot of friends and lovers who have a hard time with their cycles.
Yeah.
And so maybe just as a starting place, in addition to this conversation, if you personally have resources or there's things that you would direct people towards, and then maybe give us like a couple of the juiciest examples of some of the work that you do, because I think that'd be helpful.
Okay. I won't go into it in too much detail because I think this part I expressed in the last podcast, so maybe go back and listen to that one.
Cool.
But in a woman's menstrual cycle, there are four distinct phases and they're defined by the hormones, but it's this recognition that shifting of a woman's hormones in her cycle not only affects her physical body preparing her for pregnancy, but also massively affect her psycho-emotional reality. So there are parts of a cycle where a woman is much more available to you and other times where she's much more inward. Part of her cycle when she's going to be much more sensitive and easily irritated, and other times where she's much more resilient. Times where she's more creative and can get a lot of shit done, other times where she's disorganized and chaotic and that's the way it's meant to be. So to understand that about a woman, for a woman to understand that about herself and for men to understand that about the women in their lives is a game changer because it just offers space for so much more acceptance. And inside of acceptance, there's just much more easeful living, right? It's like, this is actually the way that it is and we don't have to fight it. We can understand it, be curious about it, like you said, and then work with it and around it because it's the nature of things where we are, as in female bodies, we are very tuned in line with the cycles of nature. You know, we're affected by the cycles of the moon. We're part of that rhythm. We see the earth go through its cycles with the seasons. We go through those same seasons every month. Yeah, accepting the cyclical nature of what it is to be human and incorporating that rather than trying to be one consistent way all the time because it's just not the way of things.
Well, and one thing that I'll flag, I know we talked about this the last time because it's my favorite part of this, is this idea of menstruation itself as a mythopoetic trip to the underworld.
Yes.
And that explains the wisdom of the crone.
Yes.
The crone has the wisdom of how many trips she's taken to the underworld that process.
That's right.
And that's so cool.
And how well she's, not a good term to describe, but how, maybe even how supported she's been in that, how self-aware she was in that. If she grew up in a community like back in the day where women all knew that and respected that and all bled together and went through that together, it was revered. And then that's very different to like a contemporary woman that's seeing her period as a curse and taking painkillers and just trying to bust through it and pretend it's not happening. Her capacity to tap into and receive the jewels of that dip into the underworld's going to be very different, right? So on average, and this is very varied, but on average, a woman menstruates for 40 years. So if there has been 40 years of 13 times a year dipping into the underworld in a conscious, supported, revered way, yeah, you're gonna move into the crone cycle of your life as a wise woman, you know, and how beautiful it would be to bring that back. So that's what I've tried to do with a part of my work is really support that understanding in women and their partners so that there can be a little more of that honoring and creating a space that can happen a little more.
You mentioned Kuan Yin. Mm-hmm. And in my writing, I discovered a hot take on Kuan Yin that I love, which is that Kuan Yin is the first and kind of longest trans figure. So Kuan Yin was born as an Indian male bodhisattva, Avalokiteshvara. I can't pronounce the name properly. But Kuan Yin started as an Indian bodhisattva. And as she moved to China and she evolved, there was a period of like 700 years where Chinese Buddhist scholars were debating whether this bodhisattva could possess infinite compassion and infinite mercy and be male. And over time, Kuan Yin was, she had two names and she was male and female. Uh-huh. And there's some Kuan Yin statues where she's got the little mustache.
Really?
And that ultimately she kind of landed as Kuan Yin, this goddess of compassion that's so feminine. And yet actually, in what I was reading about is that she's actually not stable there. Her gender is still kind of shifting and she is looked at in different ways. She's sort of homogenized into our sort of like global pantheon of goddesses, mm-hmm. or gods and goddesses. Kuan Yin is the ultimate
expression of feminine compassion.
It's motherly love in its ultimate state.
Yeah.
And it's so interesting that this bodhisattva if you really want to take a truly mythic lens at how the symbol of her moved through culture, she was born an Indian man.
Wow.
Isn't that cool?
I love that.
It's cool. I'll send you some.
Please. I love that.
And I want to say that because I just want to say that on this podcast. But I also wanted to use it to tee up how you feel about this modern trans movement. Hmm. You know, and obviously when we talk about trans issues, trans rights, that sort of thing, it is in the category of subjects where we often want to be careful with our words.
Yeah.
When groups are targeted in certain ways, we want to be very mindful about how we speak about those groups. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't speak about them at all. I'm curious how the work that you've done, particularly around these courses that include things like the feminine arts, deity embodiment stuff, how has that intersected for you with the trans movement?
Such a huge question.
They're all huge. Have you noticed? They're all huge questions.
I mean, always,
this time.
Always. I expect nothing less, Eamon. I mean, the first thing that I want to say is just there is so much I don't know about this. So much I don't know. And we've touched on many times how we're constantly evolving our perception of so many things, including our own relationship to the masculine and feminine, our own beings, let alone our understanding of what it's like for other people that have a very different experience of their exploration of their gender. So, you know, really my stance is curiosity. That's really my stance. I don't have a lot of opinion around this. We were just kind of talking about how hormones have such a radical effect on so many aspects of your personality as a menstruating woman, for example. So once you get in and start influencing things in that way, then, you know, this sense of identity that's making the choice is now influenced by the hormones. And it's a very complicated conversation.
You want to know something funny? Mm-hmm. I'm taking gender-affirming hormones.
Okay.
I'm 41. Uh-huh. And I'm boosting my testosterone.
Okay.
And it's not an injection, it's prescription. And I love it.
Right.
I love it. And so it's just so funny. One of the arguments around gender-affirming anything is that a lot of people do gender-affirming things for the gender that they were assigned as birth.
Right.
And it's not that I feel like I'm not as much of a man, but it's just as I get older, my testosterone goes down. And I did some research on it, and it's like really helpful to do. And I started doing it. And dear listener,
God, I hadn't thought about
do
it like
good
that.
Research. Don't just start taking testosterone. But for me, in my case, it was like I feel like 10 years younger.
Yeah.
I feel like my focus, my sleep, my musculature, like it's all, it's interesting. It's been really helpful for me.
Well, you know what's really interesting is because I'm now perimenopausal, my hormones have like radically changed. And so I've been working with that in different ways. And I got really interested in bioidentical hormones. So
What's that?
Bioidentical hormones is plant-based hormone therapy as opposed to HRT, like chemical HRT. So I did a bunch of research around that, and then I found somebody, and I too have just started working with these creams. But for me, I'm working with progesterone and estrogen and some DHEA and some testosterone. Mm. So it's interesting, like I'm doing that from a perimenopausal perspective. I hadn't even ever considered about this conversation that we're having now, like how that then affects your gender orientation or your way of seeing things. But of course, if I took a whole lot of testosterone, more than I'm taking right now, which is a small amount, it's very curious because what I'm doing is having a look at where my system has shifted and changed and dropped and then bringing it back into homeostasis. So that's an interesting thing to state in and of itself. Like, what is homeostasis when you're talking about gender orientation? Am I supposed to have more of this? Or do you know what I mean? Like, I never thought about it in this way until this very conversation.
Well, it's so interesting when we're talking about gender and we're talking about hormones, for both of us to be like playing with our hormones.
Right.
So when I started taking the testosterone, I was being trained by a pro dom, and I was learning a lot about BDSM and about masculinity. And actually a lot of my like integrity stuff, BDSM has been really helpful for that for me and really helpful for like my clarity about how I show up in certain ways. Because in that space, there isn't as much room for error.
Right.
Like you really need to be
boundaries
impeccable.
Are very defined.
You really need to be impeccable. But he was saying that he boosts his testosterone because it makes him feel more like himself. And I was like, okay, that's interesting. And then Andrew Huberman on the Huberman Lab was talking about that as it was helpful for depression. And I was having some trouble with that at the time. And I was like, okay, that's interesting. And so I took it. I noticed some physical changes. I noticed some focus changes. And then I noticed twice I had an experience that my behavior changed. And I knew it was because I was taking testosterone.
Right. In what way? I'm curious.
Yeah. Yeah. It's actually kind of interesting, and I haven't talked about it on the show, and I think it's worth bringing up. So once I was by myself, and once I was having lunch with my ex-fiance. So one was a man asked me for money, and then when I said, I'm sorry, I'm on my way somewhere, he slapped my shoulder. And then the other time we were dining outside, and a man came to wanted money, but also was like telling us what we should order. And I was very graciously like, hey, we're like in the middle of a conversation, would you mind? And then he touched her in each instance. And I know that it was related to having elevated testosterone. I did not become aggressive, but in each instance, I was very strict with my boundaries. Mm. And so the man who slapped my shoulder, I turned around and I was like, do not touch me. And he was like, well, and I was like, do not touch me. And I turned around and walked away. And I wasn't aggressive and I wasn't wanting to fight, but I was just like, my boundaries felt so clear.
Mm.
And then even more so with her, it was because—
You were protective.
I was protecting her. And he was harmless. And I didn't mind that he interrupted us. It's life, this poor man, whatever he's going through. So he was like, oh, you should order this. We'd already finished eating. And I was like, do you mind? Like, we're in the middle of a conversation and we're done eating. And he said something like, oh, you should order this. And he put his hand on her shoulder. And I was like, do not touch her. And he like moved his hand away. I was like, you need to move. You need to move along. And then he was walking away. And he turned around and started walking back. And I was like, have I not made myself clear?
Wow.
And then I looked back at her and she was like fanning herself. And she's like, wow, that was really hot.
Yeah.
I did not feel aggressive. I didn't feel angry. I just felt so clear on boundaries. And I felt so clear, particularly with Kelly. For me, there was no problem at all. The man was in no way threatening until he put his hand on her. Mm-hmm. And when he did, I was like, no, this is a no. You know, I was talking about aspirational masculinity around integrity and being helpful. I think for me, masculinity too is a lot about boundaries and a lot about being, I'm physically bigger and like protecting and like, so it's interesting, more testosterone created more assertive boundaries for me. Isn't that interesting?
Very interesting. You know, I'm taking a tiny little bit of testosterone because mine had dropped, which is not uncommon for perimenopausal women, and it affects their libido, amongst other things. It's not just a male hormone. It's a hormone that's present in men and women. But yeah, it's very interesting when we start to talk about hormones, right? Because it brings out these more what we consider to be masculine qualities. It's interesting. There's lots of overlap in there, right? Yeah, because if you started taking a lot of estrogen, for example, it's likely you'd become more emotionally sensitive and you'd become more permeable in some way, less of the kind of that capacity to go out on the battlefield and be with whatever comes and more like feeling everything that's happening on the battlefield because it's the nature of heightened estrogen and progesterone in the system. Like, it's interesting that we define this sense of qualities of gender around our hormones, and yet it's a much bigger picture than that, very inclusive of that, all at the same time.
I want to bring this conversation back to what I feel like is the through line here, which is the liberation of being able to express yourself as you wish in the context of gender especially, but in general, that's a liberating pursuit.
Yeah.
And it's been really interesting to me, you've talked about this path springing from this unfuckable trust of self.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to end our conversation today with a little bit more of a deeper dive into that.
Yeah.
The first time that I encountered this in you was when you were teaching our yin yoga teacher training at Yoga Barn, and you were describing your morning practice. And you were like, I used to do a specific series of things. Now my morning practice is fundamentally intuitive.
Mm-hmm.
I listen to what my body wants and I do it first thing in the morning. And weirdly, no one had ever said that to me before. I was like, well, a practice is a practice and you follow the algorithm and you do the thing.
Right.
Because the wise person tells you to do the thing and
That's
you do the
right.
thing. And so that was my first introduction to Tina Nance's inner light. The way that I'm thinking about it in this moment is this self-trust at some point was a seed and you watered it and cultivated it through listening to it and through expressing it. Now it has blossomed in many ways. There's different blossoms, feminine embodiment blossom, there's a yin yoga blossom. And I just wanna talk a bit about that process of that seed of self-trust blossoming into offerings in the world as a way of also getting us to the present moment and to what you're doing with Held.
Yeah. Ultimately, the teacher of unfuckable self-trust for me has been my body. Really, it's been because my mind gathers external information. That's a big part of its job. And then it computes all of that and comes up with ideas around it, but it's still based on external input. Whereas my body is my direct connection to my internal knowing. That's what I was discovering over time and what I was giving myself permission to listen to. And so developing that trust was really about developing the trust of that. The more I surrendered to that, just through the experience of letting my body show the way, it showed me again and again its efficacy as a tool, right? It brought me back to that place of clarity and knowing and power, like real power, as in agency, as in like a sense of fullness and wholeness and knowing of my truth, my sense of self, capital S, you know. My body would bring me back to that again and again. So in the beginning, there was also fear around it, because when I was surrendering to this energy moving through my body, one way of describing it, through a more biochemical lens, you could look at fascial unwinding as a way of describing it. However you're describing it, if you looked at it from the outside, it can look a bit nuts, you know, like I'm just letting my body unwind and move. And so there was also fear around it, fear of how it would be perceived, fear if I'd be taken seriously, fear of the energy itself. If I really surrender to it, will I go mad? Lots of fear that I had to move through. So like these little gateways that I had to pass through, little initiations. And then just moving through each of those via taking the leap and recognizing that what I feared didn't happen. I didn't go mad. I wasn't judged. Other people resonated with it and went, oh God, you're giving me permission to explore what something I've been feeling. And so as all the fears just got moved out of the way slowly, then that trust expanded more and more. I think it's infinite. The deconditioning process is infinite. That life will bring us experiences to show us places where we're not yet awake to our bullshit and, or to the stuff we've taken on and didn't even realize we were looking through a lens. We thought it's just the way things are. I think life is constantly bringing that. So I don't think I'm in a place of like, I'm totally, of course, that's not the case. But I definitely am in deep trust of the tool of my body as that which brings me back to that, no matter what I meet or face. My body brings me back to that in two main ways. One, in that it allows me to be present, and presence is where that truth lies for me. But also because my body is constantly contracting or expanding in response to what I'm thinking about any given moment. And that when my body is contracting, it's illustrating to me that what I'm thinking is not aligned with my truth. And when my body's expanding and there's a sense of internal flow is when what I'm thinking is spot on with my truth. And being in constant connection with that barometer, I trust that fully now. There's nothing in the way of that anymore. There's just, yeah, sometimes I'm distracted and not fully present with it. But when I am, that's my teacher now. I don't really study much externally anymore. I do around things like the nervous system, but certainly not around ideology or spiritual belief or ways of knowing.
Dina, tell me what you're doing with Held, and let's finish off our conversation with how people can connect with you. Mm-hmm. You live here in Bali, you teach at Yoga Barn, mm-hmm. you do some different retreats, mm-hmm. and I would love for you to share a little bit about how all of this has ultimately blossomed into who you are in this moment and what your offerings are and how people can connect.
Yeah, thanks. Held itself stands for heart-centered embodied listening as Dharma. So exactly what I'm describing, like listening to the body and heart as your Dharma, as your teacher. I have a school called Held, the School of Embodied Self-Integration. And it's really about integrating with self, capital S, via the body. So I teach that in lots of different ways. So I have different classes that I teach at a place called the Yoga Barn in Ubud, Bali. If you haven't been there, it's a beautiful place. I also teach retreats here in Bali and elsewhere. This year I'm teaching an embodied retreat in Turkey, for example.
Oh, nice.
There'll be a weekend workshop in Portugal. So I travel a little. But mainly I teach from here. There's retreats, which are 5-day or 7-day experiences, which you can explore. There's one on the embodied feminine. There's one on embodiment and somatic sovereignty. There's one on nervous system rewiring and nervous system regulation. And then a deeper immersion, other teacher trainings. So I have 6 different 100-hour teacher trainings, which you can come and do as an immersion into exploring your own relationship with your body as your teacher. Or you can learn how to teach. You can do a yin yoga teacher training or a yoga therapy teacher training working with the Chinese medicine meridian system or the embodied feminine training, which is working more with working with the hormones, but also working with the pelvis and trauma stored in the pelvis, that kind of thing. Restorative yoga training. So there's different teacher trainings that you can do as immersions, which is, you know, a large majority of people come just to do it for their self-inquiry.
As I did.
Yeah. And then also people come to then offer that as a way of being helpful with others, a way of, yeah, teaching. Yeah. So that's all of that's on offer in person. And we're also cultivating held online at the moment. So for people that can't make it to Bali or where I travel to, we're putting more and more content online. And eventually all of the 100-hour teacher training programs will be online as well. But for now, my preference is to meet people face-to-face and guide them back towards their own somatic sovereignty, their own body wisdom.
Well, and Tina, you have to go teach right now. What are you teaching
right
tonight?
Right now, Nervous System Rewire.
Oh, yeah. That's the one that I took last week, maybe around this time. Mm-hmm. Tina, it's been such a pleasure to have you back on the show. Last time it was over Zoom in the pandemic times, so now we actually get to co-regulate while discussing our hormones. I talked a lot more on this podcast than I usually do, but I'll allow it.
Oh, I love it. It's such a catalyst for me because everything, like you said in reverse, everything that you say inspires so many things I want to talk about. I want to go in 10 different directions at once.
Well, and that's expansion. You know, that's expansion.
Yeah,
and
that's right.
I always know a good podcast because I feel energized afterwards, and I feel quite energized after speaking
too.
With you.
Such a pleasure.
Yeah, and so
thank
good to
so
see you.
Thank you so much, sweetheart.
Have a great class.
Thank you. Bye, everyone.
Thank you for joining us for Life is a Festival. If you liked the show, you can support it by sharing it with your friends, following it on Spotify, or reviewing it on iTunes. If you'd like to get more involved, you can join our Facebook group, Life is a Festival, where we talk about the show and you can suggest new guests. If you really liked the show and maybe want a little bit more, visit my digital tip jar at patreon.com/lifeisafestival.com. Whatever you do, I hope today's podcast helped you make your life just a little bit more like a festival, and I'll see you on the dance floor.